versus Wells Fargo.
Good morning, Your Honor, Counsel. My name is Nancy Lisher, and I represent the defendant appellant, Wells Fargo Home Mortgage. This is obviously a dispute between a mortgagee and a mortgagor, and the facts are uncontroverted that my client, Wells Fargo, formerly known as Norwest, timely tendered payment at all times. However, the story starts when a new ID number, tax ID number, is assigned when the plaintiffs combine two pieces of property and my client inadvertently submits a tax payment under the wrong tax number. The plaintiff has agreed that this is a mistake and an error, but he identifies the first misstep that is egregious by my client as being ignoring the refund of that payment in October of 1995.
I wonder, Ms. Lisher, though, if we could jump ahead one small step further in the story, because I thought, in a certain respect, that the way the district court resolved this really all hinges on the misrouting of that February 1996 letter. Had Norwest sent that letter indicating that the Ms. Artman, I guess everybody's calling her the tax scavenger, if that had gone to the right place, this whole problem would have been nipped in the bud, right? Because at that point, it would have become apparent to both Norwest, your client's predecessor, and everybody else interested, that this glitch had occurred, and preventive steps could have been taken then before somebody shows up in the door and announces that they're evicting people from their homes.
First of all, that notification was in violation of Illinois law because there were redundant notices that had to be given to the plaintiffs and to the defendants, plus Artman was supposed to deliver notice to the clerk. There would have been a second round of notices to both the plaintiff and to the defendant.
So you mean even the February 96 notice
was improper, and that was
defective.
Stipulated. That was part of that stipulation.
Okay.
Second, the fact that it was sent to Iowa to a post office box, it's true that the mortgage document said that was the correct address, but Illinois law governs here. It's the Illinois Tax Procedure Act, which is 35 ILCS 200/22 et sec. That's what is required, and there are very specific requirements for this notice. If it's to an individual like the Parks, it had to be personal or abode, there had to be certified mail, there had to be sheriff summons along the way, there had to be duplicative notices at least twice, once of the tax sale and once of that the redemption period was about to expire. A third set of notices had to be given before Artman presented the tax petition to get the tax deed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, and the party stipulated that all notices were incorrect and in violation of state law. So that's in the separate appendix, the last document there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But let's assume for argument's sake there was a problem.
I at least thought that was sort of the pivotal point of what the Parks are focusing on here.
Well, the problem with that is that it's a single mistake. I have an Iowa employee who misroutes this. This is something that we discovered in 1999. And the question is, what was the jury thinking when they did a $3 million punitive damage award for the mistake by an Iowa employee in routing a piece of paper?
Were you trial counsel?
No. No. My law firm was. A single mistake in and of itself might give rise to a breach of contract case, and that's really what I wanted. Well, I wanted to talk about this because I think what we have to do is that the plaintiff's real complaint here is that they were defrauded and deceived, and that's true, but it wasn't by their mortgage company because we were equally defrauded and equally deceived by Artman, the tax scavenger who violated all Illinois law notices. At one point, even after a stay was in order, she sneaked into court and got an ex parte order.
She what in court?
After the tax proceedings were stayed, after everything was developed, that was in February. In May, Artman went back into court without telling anybody.
What was the term you used?
Sneaked.
Yes, and I believe that's actually in the record. That's how Mrs. Parks described it.
And that's how you describe it? People sneak into court?
Well, in this case, it was going into court without prior notice and obtaining an ex parte order in violation of a stay order. She got a second order of possession by, again, not giving notice to anyone.
But that one was reversed in lickety-split time, though,
yes,
right?
Within hours. And we also didn't get notice of that. We were, by that time, we had been given leave to intervene.
Mm-hmm.
Your Honors, when the plaintiff sued in tax court, they really received all the relief from this fraud freezer. That tax title was vacated and held for naught. They obtained sanctions for all the deceitful, malicious, devious, and actual fraud, which is how the tax court made a finding, from Artman when they got an order granting their motion for sanctions and got their fees paid except for the $2,000. And again, my client was as deceived as the plaintiff by that tax scavenger. The plaintiff, after recovering from the tax scavenger, then sued this defendant. But the nature of plaintiff's complaint against this defendant is not fraud, malice, intentional deceit, which was all the basis of Artman's conduct, which resulted in vacating that tax deed and an award of sanctions. Rather, the nature of this case is the loss of the benefit of the bargain. It's a simple breach of contract case. The plaintiff has the option to either pay taxes directly or have them escrowed.
Could I just say, I mean, I understand this argument, but the magistrate judge, at several points, actually, under several theories, the Consumer Fraud Act theory, other theories, concedes that there was no evil motive, there was no, you know, maliciousness on the part of Norwest, and so he turns to this reckless indifference to the rights of others theory. I really think he kind of sees it that way throughout, and it's the fact that I guess this set of mistakes wasn't detected any sooner that causes him to find recklessness. Maybe you could comment on that.
Well, the first answer has to be the chronology, because we have a payment under a wrong number, then there's a refund. Contrary to what plaintiff said, we didn't ignore it. We took two investigative steps. The first is we sent a letter. Now, there's a hot dispute about whether the letter itself went out, but my corporate knowledge and the entry on the computer log says this routine computer-generated letter went out, and we don't really contest that the plaintiffs didn't get it. That's what they testified to. We accept that. But the truth is we didn't ignore the refund. This isn't very clear, I don't think, in the brief, but when you look at the chronology, we get no response from our letter, but there's a tax sale on December 11th. After the tax sale, Artman pays the taxes, gets this property, at least at that point, and after the tax sale, about 2 weeks later, the defendant takes the second investigative step after that first refund and says, well, what happened? And they're told, well, the taxes were paid. So they dutifully put into the computer, taxes were paid by the homeowner, and this is a very common thing, and there is testimony to that in that respect.
They're told by
County.
Yeah.
That the record showed, and so that chronology shows. I'm sorry.
I just wondered whether the record shows whether this particular county routinely sends a copy of the tax bill to the homeowner along with the copy of the tax bill to the mortgagee. It certainly some counties in Illinois do, I know. Or whether it doesn't say anything about that, or whether we know.
As far as I know, it's not in the record. What is in the record is that in Cook County you get tax bills. I live in Cook County. I get my tax bills.
Yeah, DuPage County does too, I know. But, I mean, this county may be different, so
yeah.
I don't know.
Anyway, after we get this misleading information from the county, and remember, the first refund is our first misstep.
They tell you it's paid by the homeowner is what they told you?
Well, that's what the computer entry says. I don't think they ever found the person who made the computer entry, but we have this business record that says that. For the next 3 years, except for that the Iowa employee who misroutes this notice that gets sent to a post office, again, in Iowa, but for 3 years, we dutifully pay our taxes. For 6 payments, nothing happens. The defendant has nothing to think that something's wrong. And in 19, we have...
Are you paying it on that number that now encompasses both lots, the correct number?
I don't know if that's in the record. What we do know is that they are being paid on Parks property properly. Now, I can't tell you I have that information specifically, but I know that those tax payments were made, that the taxing authority or the county is attributing this to the plaintiff's property.
Is it post-tax sale or pre-tax sale or conveyance of the tax pursuant to the scavenger line?
We were making payments after the tax sale.
So you were paying...
And they were not being refunded.
In fact, you were paying the tax scavenger's tax.
We were paying the tax scavenger's taxes, yes, effectively that's correct. And the tax scavenger doesn't get around to paying taxes until right before the redemption period and right before she goes to court and gets the tax deed.
I was going to say, at least Magistrate Judge Gorman makes the assumption in his order, this is on page 3 of his opinion, page 5 of your appendix, he says, Norwest continued to make the twice yearly tax payments until 1998, apparently using the correct identification number. So I don't know where he got that from, but...
Well, I think that's because we know that...
They didn't send it back.
They didn't send them back, right.
So that would be
the only
logical.
Time.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
The only time they send them back is when somebody else pays them, and that was Artman in 1996, and then, 1995. And 3 years later, we get our second refund. And this is the third misstep that the plaintiffs have identified. I would submit that the nature of this case is that the plaintiffs are complaining that they didn't get the benefit of the bargain from the mortgage company, which contracted to pay for taxes and did not. This is not a situation where the mortgage company would have intentionally ignored this because... And I would like to just focus this court's attention on the plaintiff's own words in the tax court. Certainly, a lending institution as sophisticated as Norwest, now Wells Fargo, would not stand by and allow its security interest to be extinguished as a result of the failure to pay one tax payment and with the knowledge that the owner would likely never pay off the mortgage or the loan after losing the property. The plaintiff's words say it all. The plaintiffs and the defendants were in the same situation when it came to this tax scavenger. We both had an interest in the property. We didn't want to lose the collateral to our loans. We are not in the business of losing our collateral or security. And they didn't want to lose their interest in their house.
Did you have a fiduciary duty?
No,
Did
sir.
You?
There's, I believe, no case holds that a fiduciary duty is owed from a mortgagee to a mortgagor. But the Seawood, Durkee, and the third case, which I can't remember, that I cited in my case, have all squarely held that this is a breach of contract case. This isn't a fiduciary claim. Seaway also says this isn't a consumer fraud claim. If it's a breach of contract claim, you can't go in under these other theories. And certainly, the Illinois Supreme Court has held clearly you get no damages for emotional distress or for punitive damages even if a person's home is at stake. That's the Morrow case, which cites Rodarowicz. If I may, Your Honor, if there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Hunziker.
May it please the court, good morning, may it please counsel. The panel, I was going to begin by talking briefly on issues surrounding fiduciary duty and consumer fraud. I feel somewhat compelled to begin by discussing the appropriateness of Judge Gorman's ruling to submit the issue of punitive damages to the jury, which again would be an abuse of discretion standard.
But you know, I guess I wish you could tell me what, in your view, would amount to ordinary negligence if these three things didn't. You know, if putting the wrong number down once and misreading a piece of paper and the kinds of things that apparently happened here, that from your own account of the facts, they certainly are missteps. I mean, nobody would say otherwise, but to characterize them as anything but acts of ordinary negligence makes me wonder what would, if this isn't ordinary negligence, what is?
Very good. And actually, Judge Gorman articulated that fairly well in a few of his orders, and I can very, very quickly bullet point.
Well, I mean, if you can. I read his orders, and I'm not sure I thought it was so terrific. But anyway, what are you relying on in his
order? If the court would look at any one or two particular acts or omissions that Wells Fargo engaged in, one would certainly or could certainly conclude that it amounted to mere negligence. However, when looking at the totality of the circumstances...
What, three acts? I mean, you know,
absolutely,
in the end, when things come to a head, when Artman shows up at the door, they swing into gear very quickly and have two people on the job, and they figure out actually quite rapidly what's going on, and they forestall disaster.
Judge, there were several more instances than just the three, in fact. We had the second installment, 1994 taxes that were missed. The letter that they say was produced but cannot be found was not received by our client. The parks never received that letter. The parks were never contacted. I think as a matter of public policy, when someone's mortgage is in jeopardy or there's a problem with it, there should be a public policy to where that mortgage company gets hold of the mortgagor and puts them on notice of that.
Well, how are they supposed to know? I mean, the magistrate judge never finds that the letter wasn't sent. That's not a finding of fact. He finds that there's this dispute, if you will, I mean, or unfortunate lack of clarity, since he certainly does find it wasn't received, but that doesn't mean it wasn't sent.
But the saga continues. Wells Fargo makes the assertion that they contacted the county and made some kind of inquiry. However, the notes of Wells Fargo suggest that inquiry revealed information that was false, and the information that was false should have been detected because they had correct information in Wells Fargo's file.
But why should it have been detected if, as the record seems to show, and common sense actually suggests, one of the most common mistakes made with taxes is double payment. The mortgagee pays and the mortgagor pays, and the county said, or the record, at least the business record, indicates. Why would you be alerted to the fact that that report is a mistake?
Because the report that they received from the county indicates that the parks has made more than one tax payment. However, only one tax payment at that particular point in time had been returned to Wells Fargo.
Oh, I know, but suppose the parks had been unsophisticated people and there had been an information tax bill sent to them and they didn't realize that under the terms of their mortgage agreement, the mortgagee was going to pay that, so they send off whatever, you know, suppose $2,000, whatever it is. They send off the payment out of their savings account. So it never flows through Norwest or the escrow account. Norwest wouldn't know that. And yet that scenario happens with some regularity.
In the instant case, per the mortgage that they had, the parks had with Wells Fargo, they received no notices.
Well, I understand in this case their mortgage said that Norwest was supposed to pay it, but a lot of people don't memorize the fine print in their mortgage agreement. And so I'm just trying to figure out from Norwest's point of view, when they're told by the county this payment has already been made, what is it in that statement that alerts them to the fact that something is amiss?
two things. One, they only received one payment back. If the Parkses had made more than one payment, or someone else besides the Parkses.
But it was only the one payment that was at issue. They shouldn't have received notice that two payments had been missed.
The county had suggested in their records that more than one payment had been made twice, which would mean Wells Fargo would have received back more than one check. They only
I don't remember that being part of the notation.
In Mrs. Waddell's notes, in fact, I can paraphrase here.
Well, I remember it's in the brief somewhere.
Wells Fargo characterized it as a typographical error and said homeowner paid second installment also. Well, they didn't pay the second installment also because there was no payment received back from Wells Fargo. And in fact, the testimony is of the record that Parkses never made any payment.
No, I think it said homeowner made first installment, and Wells Fargo said that must mean second because only one installment came back, and it was the second one. I'll just find it.
Regardless, again, they're put on notice as to why that tax payment was received back. No investigation was done as to why it simply placed back into the general ledger account and eventually back into the Parkses escrow account. Then we have this February 1996 take notice, which says in bold print, tax sale imminent, take immediate action. And again, nothing was done.
That's when they misfiled.
Correct. But again, they had actual notice of
right.
that.
All I'm saying is, you're saying misfiling is an act beyond ordinary negligence. And I'm wondering why it is.
When looked at in the totality of all of the things that Wells Fargo did, it cumulatively amounts to more than mere negligence. Then, continuing, the August 1998 payment is returned. Again, no action, no contact to the park. The certified mail from Kathy Artman, which went to the wrong P.O. box and was returned because Wells Fargo did not update the P.O. box records with the county.
Where the opponent says that Kathy Artman was not complying at all with, she wasn't supposed to send only one notice. For one
true.
Thing. And so why doesn't that, I mean, well, one of the theories that's argued is intervening.
And I'll address that specifically right now. The fact of the matter is, Kathy Artman mitigated the Parkses' damage. Had Kathy Artman complied with the tax sale laws of the state of Illinois, the Parkses would not have gotten their home back. The only reason they got their home back is because Kathy Artman missed a step. But for what Kathy Artman did wrong, the Parkses would not own their home today.
I have to say that seems preposterous to me. If Kathy Artman had sent all of the notices out that she should have done back in February 96, the Parkses would have learned much sooner that the second installment had been missed and they could have gotten to the bottom of it, and what happened eventually in 1999 would have happened in 1996.
Yet, Wells Fargo still had actual notice of the situation in such a time that they could rectify the situation and absolve any negative consequences.
So you agree with me? They could have fixed it in 96 if Kathy Artman had complied.
They could have fixed it several times along the way.
If Kathy Artman had complied, they could have fixed it in 1996.
I respectfully disagree because Kathy Artman
didn't send anybody the right notices, it didn't send anybody the right notices, actually.
I believe it is disingenuous for Wells Fargo to make that assertion. They can't come here with clean hands and make that assertion because they had actual notice.
No.
Whether or not Kathy Artman made the correct...
They had legal notice. They didn't have actual notice.
They had actual notice in the form of a certified letter that a tax sale was imminent. They had actual notice in February 1996.
What action did they take when they got the certified letter?
Absolutely nothing.
It was misfiled, right? They made
correct.
The clerk made a mistake.
Correct.
And for that, they paid $3 million?
It goes all along what I said over the last 5 or 10
no,
minutes.
No, your theory has to be that this is such a sloppily run company that couldn't care less about losing as many of its secured properties as possible, whether they have 80% of the interest in the property and the homeowner has 20, or whether they have 20 and the homeowner has 80. They're just in the business of losing their secured interest in property all over the country by failing by an extremely sloppy tax department that just doesn't bother to pay taxes. If so, if they're that cavalier with people's property interests and with their own interests. A, their shareholders should be very concerned, and B, certainly punitive damages might be appropriate. But I'm having trouble seeing that record here.
Judge Gorman, after the close of evidence of the trial, made a detailed evidentiary ruling that there was sufficient evidence to submit the issue of punitive damages.
I understand that, and we are here to review what Judge Gorman did.
Correct.
So,
on an abuse of discretion standard.
And part of abuse of discretion concerns the question whether the right legal standards have been applied.
Correct.
Which is something this court will decide.
Correct.
Right.
Okay. Any other questions on that issue?
How about your fiduciary argument?
With respect to fiduciary duty, under the Mortgage Escrow Account Act, it's a special deposit. Counsel mentioned the Seaway case. The fact of the matter is a pure depositor-depositee relationship does not create a fiduciary duty. The fact that a person has a mortgage with a bank or some other financial institution in and of itself does not create a fiduciary duty. What creates the fiduciary duty is the existence of the escrow, the special account, which are segregated funds, designated funds, funds that are returned to the homeowner if, in fact, that they are not used. Again, Judge Gorman went into great detail in terms of his analysis that the escrow in this particular situation constituted a special deposit, thus placing the bank into a fiduciary capacity with this particular homeowner. Frankly, it's a classic trustee scenario, one person entrusts funds for a specified purpose, and those funds have to be carried out in that fiduciary capacity. In this particular situation, they were not. That's all I have.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Swisher, how much time? You have 6 minutes for rebuttal. You want to address the escrow fiduciary relationship?
Yeah. Your Honor, I believe there are four cases in Illinois, and all of them have rejected that a fiduciary duty is owed, including the case cited by the plaintiff, that would be Ransom versus A.B. Dick. The third case, besides Seaway and Durkee, is the city court case. You know, the Illinois legislature clearly has created fiduciary duties when it wants to, and it did not in the Mortgage Act. So I think that's something that this court, not only do we have all Illinois courts construing Illinois law to hold no fiduciary duty is owed, and of course this is, these same cases say, look, this is a breach of contract case, this is a contract relationship, but we also have the Illinois legislature silent on this point.
What about the characterization, though, of the escrow account as a special account that needs to be handled in particular ways, not commingled and so on?
Well, it wasn't commingled.
Yeah,
and we didn't...
Well, Judge Gorman takes the jump from saying, if it's a special account, ergo, there's a fiduciary relationship. There is always a fiduciary relationship, it seems to say.
Well, I disagree. The Illinois legislature has said there's an escrow law. This is what happens with mortgage companies. One of the things we had to do is give the parks the option to either pay taxes by themselves or to have us pay them. I mean, this was all a matter of Illinois legislature, and they did not create that remedy. And Illinois.
From a failure to pay the taxes out of the escrow fund would not be a fiduciary violation. That is, they give you the money to pay the taxes, and they do, and you put it in an escrow fund. And you fail to pay the taxes, have you violated any fiduciary relationship at all?
No, Your Honor. At most, it's a breach of contract. Of course, in this case, we made every single tax payment.
No, I'm not.
Yeah,
I'm,
I know
we're
that.
Talking in the abstract.
In the abstract, I think that's still simply. That's what Seaway said.
If I gave you, as my lawyer, I gave you the money and asked you to pay the taxes, and you failed to do that, would there be a fiduciary relationship? Pardon me, attorney client relationship, but that escrow relationship by itself.
Outside of the mortgage escrow relationship?
Yeah.
I mean, it gets very complicated as a lawyer because I do owe a fiduciary duty to my clients. But
your fiduciary relation to your client is to give him good legal advice, not to mislead him and so on. Don't say anything about an escrow.
Well, actually, I'm not allowed to commingle. There's a number of things. But no, Your Honor, I think it's a breach of contract. If two people say, I'm giving you this money for this purpose, make a payment and they don't follow through on that contract, under those facts, I would have to say it's a breach of contract and not a fiduciary. The fiduciary relationship simply doesn't arise just because there's a breach of contract.
If there,
that's what Seaway says.
It does not arise, in your opinion, on an escrow relationship between the escrow agent and the depositor of the escrow. There's no fiduciary relationship. If I understand what you said, that's the legal contract relationship, and only a breach of contract would involve the failure to use the escrow funds the way they were supposed to be used.
Inside the context of a mortgage relationship, this is
my position. Inside the context of an escrow relationship.
Judge, I can't answer that question, to be honest. I know there's a law out there, and there are statutes, and I don't know those statutes.
Assuming the existence of a fiduciary relationship in an escrow relationship, a principal agency fiduciary relationship established by the putting in the escrow with a specific purpose. Is there anything different about the escrow agency held by a mortgage company or held by an individual? Why is the mortgage company...
I still
company
think it's just a breach of contract, Your Honor.
So the answer is there is no fiduciary relationship in the escrow arrangement, no matter how you slice it.
Correct, based on... I don't know the Illinois statutes for all escrow accounts. So with that proviso, I think it's not a breach of contract.
Actually, the statute alone is not the primary source of fiduciary relationships. That's a matter of common law, and commercial code has all sorts of things on it, but common law has established the fiduciary in certain situations.
But in this instance, Seaway, Citicorp, Durkee, and plaintiff's own case, I mean, there's no law out there that he cited that I found that said a fiduciary duty is raised in this context. I mean, they all said, they all rejected that argument. Mm.
They all reject the argument on the escrow payment.
For an escrow and, I mean, for a mortgagee and a mortgagor, correct, Your Honor. Are there any further questions?
Consumer fraud, do you want to talk briefly about that?
Your Honor, I would simply refer you again to the Seaway case, which involves the breach of a contract of mortgage documents, and the court held there is no consumer fraud. But again, for the same reasons that there was no egregious, malicious, intentional, deceitful conduct, although mistakes, certainly, that there is no consumer fraud. And Seaway says, look, just because you breach a contract doesn't mean it gives rise to a consumer fraud claim.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.